That on the platform of that fascinating survey that's covered many centuries, we're going to ask Karen Greenberg to give us a perspective on the issue of human rights in the 21st century and the immediate challenges that we face today.
So Clemens did 2,000 plus years, and I only have to do 9. So I apologize for how focused my talk today is going to be. I want to thank Marjorie and Lance and Jermaine for today. And I'd like to thank the Vibert Dreyfus Collection. You should know about me that my passion, or one of my passions, is document collection. And mostly the work of the center I direct is focused on collecting documents. Unfortunately, the documents we've collected in the recent past are all documents not about international human rights, but about the United States and about the United States' strategic decision at the highest levels of government to step away and out of the international human rights conversation. And so today I'm going to take you sort of the opposite of what Clemens did, so it's a nice partnership, through some very specific things about what has happened in this country in the past 8 years, what is happening inside the Obama administration now, specifically on the topic of torture, which I would say is at least one of the things that is the opposite of human rights, and then give you a few reflections on it. And I thought, given this whole emphasis on documents today, and I'm going to read to you from a number of documents that have come out in the past week, actually. To just start with the story, and you'll see why later. When I was a graduate student a very long time ago, and I was doing my first document collection, I think I've done, I don't know, a lot since then, I was doing a 3-volume collection of documents on the Nazi period. And in specific, I was looking at the United States and its response to the rise of Nazism in the 1930s. And so the documents actually were fascinating and interesting. But they included Nazi paraphernalia and posters from the 1930s, 33, 34, 35, many of which were in German, but not all of them. And because some I had gotten in the United States. And I had an infant son at the time. And I don't know, I must have walked out of the room at one point. And I came back in and I saw him crawling on top of these Nazi posters, you know, on top of the swastika and on top of the the uniforms. And the image froze for me a moment. And I thought, you know, I just don't want to do this. I don't want to be a young mother bringing up children. And I'm not going to do this. And so I finished the document collection. I finished my PhD and I switched my field and did a double PhD in American political history and decided that I wouldn't spend my life mired in that kind of research. And lo and behold, it turns out that I don't have control, because here I am many decades later, right back where I started, working on document collections about human rights. And so I think there's a lesson in that, and that's why, as you'll see, the focus of my talk today is about where we are right now and what we think we're doing about it. So I thought I would tell you, and perhaps you all know it, but I'll tell you my perspective, having spent the last 6 years looking at documents from the Bush years, from the Bush Department of Justice, from the Bush Pentagon, various other sources, how we got to where we are now. And where we are now is the International Committee of the Red Cross issued a report in 2007, which came out 2 weeks ago, or leaked 2 weeks ago, which basically documented tortures well beyond what we had known before. This week, four documents came out from the Bush administration, which I'm going to read to you from, about what exactly has been done by American CIA agents and others. And so how did we get here? And I thought I would just give you a couple of signposts along the way so you might be able to understand. And I apologize if this is very specific and not particularly abstract or philosophical, but that's why we had such a wonderful opening talk. To me, the story of how we got to where we are in the matter of torture began on November 13th, 2001, well before any torture was committed and well before any torture policies were written, codified, or approved by any lawyers. On November 13th, 2001, President Bush issued a military order. That military order said that all matters of detention in the War on Terror, including trials for detention, would be transferred from all agencies in the government to Donald Rumsfeld as the Secretary of Defense. It would be up to the Secretary of Defense and to the President, according to this executive order, to make decisions about detention and trials, which could have made sense in the context we were in. But because of that document, a number of things happened, and I'll just tell you. The first is that there was no reviewability for any of the decisions made by the Secretary of Defense and the President. This military order was based on an order that Franklin Roosevelt had written at the time of the Second World War. And in his order, there were mechanisms of accountability for how to second-guess the President or whoever else was going to make decisions. In this document, there were none such. Also, the first time that the Secretary of State or the National Security Advisor heard about these documents, if we are to believe them, and I don't know why we shouldn't, was when they were announced to the public. And so a fierce dividing line sort of was constructed early on, within 2 months after 9/11, basically saying that there were some people who would make policy and some people who would be left out of the policy. The two officers who would be left out of the policy were Colin Powell and Condi Rice and their legal teams. And one of the higher ranking members of this group that I've just named, when I interviewed, said to me, you know, I went to the Department of Defense and I said, you can't leave me out of this discussion because I am the following high ranking official and it's my job to oversee legally any documents that come out that are a military order. And the response was, not anymore. It's not your job anymore, and if you have a problem with it, you can talk to Al Gonzalez in the White House, who was then the counsel to Bush. So the beginning of this story is one of secrecy and exclusivity. And although a lot of people focus on that, I'd like to point out one other part of it. The most damaging part of this, the way in which this order was issued, was not about secrecy, to my mind, or that wasn't great. It wasn't about exclusivity, because in times of trauma and stress, who knows how people react. It was the decision that the professionals, whether they were the National Security Advisor or the Secretary of State or the lawyers, that the professionals were no longer the people who should determine the codes, the regulations, and the way in which they went about business in Washington. And so this military order sent a signal. And between the military order and probably the document all of you know about that was issued on August 1st of 2002, a nine-month period, the Bush administration proceeded to create the legal ground for detention, interrogation, and torture policy that, unfortunately, I have to spend my weekends reading about now, and that the nation is now learning about. And I'm not going to go through all the signposts along the way, but I thought that I would just talk a little bit about the one thing you need to know about the torture memo from August 2002, which was that torture was redefined. Torture was redefined not as it was codified under U.S. law or as under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, not as it was accepted under the Geneva Conventions or the Convention Against Torture. Torture was redefined as to be not that which just had certain kinds of pain and suffering, both psychological and physical, but only pain, physical pain, that was tantamount to death or organ failure, and only psychological pain that could show documented, long-lasting results. And we always thought that it was bad, that it was somewhat nefarious that torture had been redefined. But actually, none of us knew until 2 days ago just how far that redefinition of torture was going to take. So I thought I would tell you a little bit about what the torture policy was, how it came, some extra ingredients to how it came about, and then what the Obama administration is trying to do to unwrite what has been written, which is not going to be easy, as you will hear. One of the, there were two enablers in this process that have not really been written about or discussed, and I think one of the reasons is that there's just so much to absorb that it's hard to think outside of these issues. One of the first enabling patterns in this step away from human rights conventions at home and abroad was naivete. There was considerable debate, as you're going to find out over the course of the summer, within the Bush administration. There were numerous people, among them Colin Powell, who said, we're not going to go down this road for many reasons. One of its compromises are our men, if they're captured, our men and women, if they're captured. For another reason, we're the country that leads the human rights agenda for the world. For another reason, it's illegal. But as one of the highest ranking official lawyers in the government said to me, you know, it just seemed easier at the time to sign the memo, tell them to classify it, and nothing would ever come of it. The thought that they would use this to create a torture policy, and I don't think these people are being disingenuous. I think they just thought it was off the charts, that people wanted to have some options available to them should there be another attack or should there be another imminent attack. And by classifying some of these documents, they thought it's just going to go away, we'll put it in the vault, and we'll forget about it. And this happened time and time again. Second enabling element that has not been talked about at all and that I think is interesting, I mean, just for us as human beings who can recognize these kinds of responses, is complicity. It was ingenious the way in which the Bush administration reached out to people in the academic community, my community, and in the legal community for advice. I'd love to see the phone log for who they called to say, do you think we could get away with just stepping away from the conventions this way? Do you think we could just sort of have a different kind of law about, you know, maybe how long they can be in solitary confinement? Do you think, when you talk about hot and cold, what temperature exactly, I'm not kidding you, what temperature exactly do you think that the water should be? I mean, what do you think the parameters are? And so behind the scenes, and at one conference actually that I went to at Harvard, that was an off-the-record room of dignitaries discussing this well before Abu Ghraib, there was the sense of complicity. And this pattern of complicity, intentionally bringing people in a little bit, I think made any kind of opposition when it mattered up till now sort of nil. So those are things that aren't usually mentioned. I think you have to understand before we go forward and understand this. So what happened? The first thing that happened was that legally, the Bush administration said we are not going to have prisoners of war in the war on terror. And what they meant by not having prisoners of war was we don't recognize a law that applies to Al Qaeda, and in some instances to the Taliban. There is no law that will apply. Now, students of the Geneva Conventions will tell you that there is no category of human being within a battle situation, civilian or otherwise, that is not codified in one way or another under the Geneva Conventions. However, the Bush administration declared it. They called these people unlawful enemy combatants. And by taking them out of a group of categorizable, recognizable human beings, they took their first and most nefarious step away from the law, and they removed the law. And in doing so, these people are not prisoners of war, they are not subject to the law, they sort of, the rest was almost foreseeable. I mean, I want to say it's in hindsight, but I don't think it's just hindsight. The second thing they did, and I know these may not seem sequential to you, but they are, is that they redefined detention and incarceration during battle and war as that which was not for trial or for keeping people off the battlefield, for keeping us safe, but for the purpose of information and of getting information. And once they had done that, the word interrogation was very quick to follow. By January of 2002, methods of interrogation were being debated by the heads of our government and by their lawyers. And of course, what happens in January of 2002 is that Guantanamo opens. When Guantanamo Bay opens, it is opened as a detention facility. And I mean, it is really open as a detention facility. It's not like a show. It's not. And over the course of its first 3 months, and this is what my book is about, is it became very clear that what the Pentagon had in mind was establishing not a detention center, but an interrogation center. And that Guantanamo would become, in some ways, the interrogation center that would help them decide how to do interrogations in other places, whether it was Abu Ghraib in Iraq or, more notably, in the CIA prisons around the world. And from the movement from regular detention to detention for interrogation to the use of techniques that were previously forbidden by just about every culture you can imagine, even the Chinese, they don't make them law. Techniques became usable. Now, I don't really want to be the one to deliver the message to you of what these techniques were, but if you read the newspaper, you will have seen in the past week that the memos that have come out from 2002 and from 2005 have illustrated these techniques in horrifying detail. You know, before we just had to live with the fact that, okay, we waterboarded people and we waterboarded people and we slapped people around and we punched them and we tied them up in various positions. But these memos describe in exquisite detail, not from the point of view of the FBI records we've seen before, this is what happened to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, this is what happened to Al-Qahtani, this is what happened to this person or that person, but this is what we're going to do. This is how many inches your hand can stay from his face. This is how you're supposed to hold your fist. This is where you're supposed to put the cloth in their mouth. And so, just to tell you, these are government documents that are step-by-step showing you how to do an interrogation. So, I mean, the trajectory is very easy and very quick. And while people call this a slippery slope, for me, this is no slippery slope. This happened immediately with the military order of November 2001, because when you transfer power in any country to the military, and it is not reviewable by anybody but the person named as the commander-in-chief, as opposed to just the president, you have set yourself a situation where there is no balance of power, there is no check. And when you take the Justice Department and the State Department and the National Security Advisor out of it at the same time, it's probably not going to end up in a good way. However, for many years, the Bush administration was asked by us and others, are you performing acts of torture? We hear from the International Committee of the Human Rights. We hear from detainees that have gone home. We hear from their lawyers who were not let into Guantanamo, for example, until 2004 and mostly 2005. Are you committing torture? And the Bush administration, with a lot of conviction, faced us all and said, absolutely not. We are not conducting torture. And we first got the August 1st memo, the one we've had for years, that's in the torture papers, and it said, you know, we've redefined it to this and that. We thought, wow, well, I guess they think they've redefined it, and maybe these things aren't torture. And some people thought they were lying, but there were a lot of us who thought maybe they were just splitting hairs, and who knew, and maybe it were isolated incidents and whatever. However, I thought I would read to you today why we weren't torturing. And this is the reason we weren't torturing. And I picked some of the more mild things because it's a beautiful Sunday afternoon and you both come out and I don't really want to, you know, extend any pain here. But the new document includes a partner to the August 1st, 2002 torture memo that's been so famous for so many years. And in this document, they describe why things aren't torture. And they do the same thing in the 2005 memo about the techniques. And so I thought I would, and I want to point out to you that in 2005, George Bush had been reelected, and he had run on a campaign that they weren't torturing. The campaign was after Abu Ghraib, and we knew everything, and we as a people decided to elect him. And so I thought I would read to you how they, when they faced everybody and said, we are not performing torture, what they were thinking was their legal backing. What had happened was they asked the CIA in late 2001, early 2002, to get some information out of the detainees that they had. And the CIA said, you want us to do that? write it down. John Rizzo, who was the general counsel to the CIA, said, you want us to do that? You got to write it down. And so what seems to have ensued was a very, we never knew how complicated until this week, conversation came out about what the CIA needed to do, and I mean specifics about how far do you need to move his head? How many seconds can he breathe for? What position will his knees be in the box? I mean, we're, okay. So they engaged in a conversation for the sole purpose of creating legal documents that said, this is not torture. And so I picked some of the milder ones. If you want to read more, you can do so on your own. These are all available online on New York Times and other sites. But just to give you some examples. A variety of stress positions may be used. You, the CIA, have informed us that these positions are not designed to produce the pain associated with contortions or twisting of the body. In other words, and you can imagine the conversation, the CIA had to say, we can do this to somebody, but it won't be painful to them. So the normal pain that would be for a normal person would not accrue. And so what you see happening here, and I'm just going to point out a few things along the way, because I don't have time to do a lot, and I want to get to the Q&A, but essentially what you... A normal person would feel pain. A terrorist will not feel pain, is part of the theme that is running through this. You know, and so you have this very odd way in which you referred to dehumanization before. You have a very odd way, and we think of dehumanization as these people are, you know, lesser human beings. This is how we know it from the 20th century, etc. But, you know, in the case of these terrorists, it's actually very interesting. In the case of the terrorists, the suspected terrorists, we're not talking about, you know, the 14 high-value detainees just, but the larger group of suspected terrorists, many of whom were sold for bounty, some of whom were guilty. What happened was that we gave them superhuman powers. Don't forget, these guys were associated with conducting 9/11. And so, in a bizarre sort of way, instead of saying, you know, who are these guys from a world we don't understand or a culture we don't understand, we enhanced their powerfulness on our own minds. And you read through the statements of Rumsfeld and Cheney and the head of the Joint Chiefs at the time, General Richard Myers, and you find statements all the time about, I mean, Richard Myers, my favorite statement is, you know, be careful with these guys, they're going to gnaw through the hydraulic lines on the planes. Are you kidding me? They were my size. They hadn't been fed in a long time. They were dehydrated. Many of them were wounded. And the same thing when they were in captivity. Be careful. They'll find a way to communicate to each other. You can put them 10 miles away from each other. You can shackle them, goggle them, hood them. So we gave them our form of dehumanization had this extra form of whatever. Okay, I'll give you some more. You, the CIA, have also orally informed us that through observing Zubeda in captivity, you have noticed that he appears to be quite flexible despite his wound. In other words, you can put him in any position you want. You can shackle him. You can put him in a box. You can do whatever you want because he's unusually flexible. Okay. Even those techniques that involve physical contact between the interrogator and the individual do not result in severe pain. This is the legal memo I'm reading from. The facial slap and walling, which in this case means jerking the prisoner's upper torso back against a false wall, contain precautions to ensure that no pain even approaching this level results. The slap is delivered with fingers slightly spread, which you, the CIA, have explained to us is designed to be less painful than a closed hand slap. The slap is also delivered to the fleshy part of the face, further reducing any risk of physical damage or serious pain. The facial slap does not produce pain that is difficult to endure. Again, none of this could be said in the eyes of the CIA or the Department of Justice, the Office of Legal Counsel, to rise to the level of pain. This just goes on and on and on, so I don't have to read it all to you, but I do want to read to you how waterboarding was handled, because when it comes right down to it, there is going to be a debate in this country about waterboarding because of these memos, because the detail in which waterboarding is planned, executed, in which it doesn't work, in which it does work, is something out of some kind of medieval manual that you can't fathom. So I thought I would read you just a little bit. Although the waterboard constitute a threat of imminent, I want you to hear the reasoning here, because I picked one that was not particularly graphic. This is about the rationality for this.
Although the waterboard constitute a threat of imminent death, prolonged mental harm must nonetheless result to violate the statutory prohibition against the infliction of severe mental pain or suffering. In other words, it would be torture if it were a threat of imminent death. That is not allowed. But waterboarding, in their case, only matters if it's going to have that other part I told you about before, which is lasting psychological pain. And what these guys conclude is that there is no lasting psychological pain from being waterboarded. But in their words, based on your research into the use of these methods at the SEER school, the training base for Army and, as you'll see, Navy SEALs when they're waterboarded, based on these methods and consultations with others with expertise in the field of psychology and interrogation, you do not anticipate that any prolonged mental harm would result from the use of the waterboard. Indeed, you have advised us that the relief is almost immediate when the cloth is removed from the nose and mouth. In the absence of prolonged mental harm, which we just established, no severe mental pain or suffering would have been inflicted, and the use of these procedures would not constitute torture within the meaning of the statute. Well, that's not the case. And they knew it wasn't the case. And this is what you're going to see debated over the course of the next month or two as the Obama administration and other human rights groups decide what to do about these memos. And I should mention here in this regard that the Senate Armed Services Committee is coming out with its report on Tuesday or Wednesday, and they too are going to focus on this issue of waterboarding. So you're just getting a little preview of what was to come. And then they added one thing. You know what? Even if somebody did think it was torture because there was a certain kind of level of physical or psychological suffering, it wouldn't be torture because it has to be the intent of the torturer to create this circumstance, and it wouldn't be the intent of these people to do so. So in no way were they going to allow waterboarding to be considered illegal. But bottom line, the Bush administration did not torture, because they had taken concepts that for centuries and techniques that for centuries had been labeled torture and redefined them, and in redefining them, they had legalized them. And in taking out any oversight mechanism, they had legalized them in a way that didn't need to be transparent, that didn't need to be known, and that could be just declared legal, and so they were. But this didn't go far enough for the Bush administration. They didn't just redefine domestic law. Not that that would have been okay, but they, you know, they had to go further. Three years later, in May 2005, they said that the Convention Against Torture was also not violated by these methods or by any of the torture techniques, because the Convention Against Torture had first to rely upon violation of the U.S. torture statute, which I've been referring to, and therefore, because it didn't violate the U.S. torture statute, it could not violate the international statute. And this is one of these overlooked moments that I think is interesting, and then in 2007, as if we didn't have enough, President Bush issued the Executive Order 13440 of July. This order reaffirms and reinforces the authority of the President to interpret the meaning and application of the Geneva Conventions. In other words, it didn't matter what any international law lawyers thought, didn't matter what any of us thought, it only mattered that the President could say what it was, and that was it. And so in a way, he didn't actually need all these legal documents, so I wish he hadn't bothered to write this all down on paper. Should have done that one first, we would have been happy. The other thing that came out this week, and it's something we sort of were expecting, but I don't know, weren't thinking about it. So remember in the very beginning I said that a fundamental part of how this happened was a disregard for the professions. The military, the uniformed military, was pushed aside very early in this policy. They were not the torturers. Abu Ghraib was within its context an aberration, which didn't mean we didn't have a torture policy. But in these particular documents, the use of psychologists and doctors to perform the torture and to make sure it could go on comes out. Now remember, these aren't my documents. These are Bush administration, Department of Justice documents. And the medical profession is going to have a long and hard look at itself after the American public, and particularly the Department of Justice, absorbs what was done to that profession. So I don't have to go through that. We have seen this before. We have seen this dehumanizing of the enemy. We've seen the rewriting of laws. We've seen the intentional and successful perversion of professions and the co-opting of those willing to play along with an inhumane and lawless regime. We have seen all too often the systematic and state-sanctioned implementation of policies designed to inflict physical and psychological damage on those deemed to be enemies, however they were defined. And so my bad news to you is that the 21st century begins, like it or not, with a revocation on part of the United States of human rights advances in the 20th century. I had a conversation with a leading official in the Justice Department this week who was intimately involved in releasing these documents, who said, you know, the problem isn't just all the cleanup that we have to do. The problem is the setback to human rights that have occurred. And it's not going to sink into you guys, that's like us, for a very long time what's happened. So they are aware at the highest levels of the government that this is not just legal, this is not just about, you know, people taking hold of the government in a wrong way, but this is about a setback to the entire concept of human rights. This is the legacy that the Obama administration has inherited. What are they going to do about it, and what have they already done about it? The first thing they did was to release these memos. They decided on day one that they were going to release these memos, and it makes a difference. I don't like reading them very much. You won't like reading them. But President Obama believes that secrecy should only go so far, and that there might be times for secrecy, but that transparency is extremely important. And this is his way of showing some sort of transparency. But as you know, on the second day of his presidency, he released three executive orders. These orders were an attempt to roll back exactly what I've described here. First, he declared torture off the books. There is not going to be any more torture, and I'm going to read to you exactly what he said. Second, he called for the closure of Guantanamo, and we'll see how that happens. And third, he called for a rethinking of our detention policy. I want you to hear the language in which he refers to the matter of human rights and the treatment of prisoners in custody. Regarding Guantanamo, no individual currently detained at Guantanamo shall be held in the custody or under the effective control of any officer, employee, or other agent of the United States government or at a facility owned, operated, or controlled by a department or agency of the United States, except in conformity with all applicable laws governing the conditions of such confinement, including Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. Regarding interrogation, effective immediately, an individual in the custody or under the effective control of an officer, employee, or other agent of the United States government, or detained within a facility owned, operated, or controlled by a department or agency of the United States in any armed conflict, shall not be subjected to any interrogation technique or approach or any treatment related to interrogation that is not authorized by enlisted in Army Field Manual 2.2.2.3. The Army Field Manual, by the way, is a non-coercive regime of getting information based on psychological manipulation and a bunch of techniques that would not be pleasant to undergo but that are not torture. The torture statute has been revived by the Obama administration. Geneva has been put back in place. The Convention Against Torture has been put back in place. And the Army Field Manual for Interrogation has been rewritten and may or may not be the law at the end of this process. I actually think they may come up with something else. The second thing the Bush administration did, that's like one big basket, was to restore process. To restore process. What do I mean by process? I mean process and structure and professionalism. By moving the judicial process to the Department of Defense, a line was crossed that shouldn't have been crossed. Obama recognized this, not just because he's a lawyer, right away. And the first thing these executive memos do is put the Department of Justice back in power. All of these issues, all of these task forces, all of the programs and policies are now directed by the Attorney General. In the case of detention, they are also directed by the Attorney General as well as the Secretary of Defense. But there's no question who's running the show, and it's a law enforcement officer and not the civilian Pentagon. On the third point, the redefinition of law, I think the feeling is that by making this obvious, by redeclaring the law that stands to be the law that should be, that they don't have to redefine the law. But I would have a caveat to this. And I guess my real question is this. Can Obama take us back to square one, given what has happened? And I don't know. But my guess is no. And I will tell you why in my concluding remarks. And I should tell you that in the international human rights community, there is a lot of talk about rethinking the Geneva Conventions and redoing the Geneva Conventions to make room for what is now considered a new category, which is these transnational jihadi or fundamentalist Islamist actors. And so if that is true, then we're not going back to square one, and maybe we can't, but it's on the table. The real question for me is if coming out of this era of Bush and entering into the Obama era, we're going to have to assume that there's a gray zone. And the idea of redoing the Geneva Conventions, or even looking at some of our own laws, introduces the idea of a gray zone. I just want to do a little riff here on what I think the damage has been. The American public has had 5 years to discuss torture, and they have not come down against it. If we hadn't had the discussion, we might not know where we stand on it. I, for one, would be happy not to know where we stand on it if we're going to support it. When we first discovered these documents, we were like, okay, well, this is it. We'll just publish these documents, we'll see it, and boom, that'll be done, we'll be over. But it hasn't changed. There are still groups I talk to all the time that are desperately believe that the only way we're going to get the information we need to get to make ourselves safer is through torture. And I would say that it's gotten much stronger, not weaker. If you watch the show 24, which I also don't recommend, but which I do watch, I will tell you that it's gotten much more defiant in its embrace of torture in this last season. And it's in the White House, and it has to do with the president's children as well as the fate of the country. And there's no question that torture works, and in this episode, that torture works in terms of keeping the country safe. But I also think that there is the issue of precedent. We have a precedent now. We have a precedent of a state policy that supported torture and of a legal system that said it was okay. And this is what my friend in the Justice Department meant when he called me the other day and said, watch out for the human rights community, because it is not going to be an easy haul. It's one thing to say, let's prosecute people, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, but there's a lot more hard work that's going to be need to be done than just prosecuting people. In essence, I think that, I referred to those enablers in the beginning, the naive within the State Department, the naive within the Justice Department, the naives elsewhere. But, I think there's been a tremendous loss of American innocence. And while there are plenty of critics who will say, look, the United States, the CIA has always tortured, we've had this manual and that manual, we know about it, I would posit that having it as a state policy, and a legalized state policy, is an extremely different matter and one that really should bear very heavily upon our conscience. And so really, I want to just close and say one thing. What is human rights in the 21st century? At least in terms of what the United States has done, it is a very damaged concept and a very necessary concept that needs to be revived. I think that the way in which the Bush administration defined torture is to consider it, defined human rights, is to consider it a luxury. Human rights are not a luxury, and now they are. And so our question is really, so how do we get it back to being a right and not a luxury? And they would say, those who defend torture, they would say it's a luxury that we need in times of, that we can use in times of stability. Well, I have something to tell you. We are not headed for stable times. We have issues of climate change, whether we believe it or not. Some form of population migration may occur. We have tremendous energy resource wars that are looming. We have potential diseases. There's a lot of instability in the world. And that's when the protection of human rights matters. And that's what mattered when the Bush administration was confronted with it, and it was the first thing they were willing to throw out. So I don't want to leave you on such a bad note, but I'm going to tell you a... but I couldn't think of anything inspiring to say. I want to leave you with this one image, because I started with that image of my son on the Nazi posters, you know, and I was like, done with that. I'm going to go do something joyous instead. But so 2 weeks ago, I was babysitting for my grandson, which is this same son's child. And I had to do an online thing for my book, and one of those web chats for the Daily Kos. And, you know, it hadn't really occurred to me. I knew I was babysitting, but I hadn't really thought about it. So I'm sitting with a baby in my lap and the computer on the couch in front of me. I'm leaning over the baby to do this. And obviously, he's 6 months old. He can't read. You know, it doesn't mean anything to him. But I immediately saw that image of my son on the Nazi posters that I had, you know, just taken out of my life. And I realized, you know, now that I'm older, and that at this time, I don't really have that choice. I don't have the luxury of saying, you know what? I'm not going to do this anymore, and there are several reasons. And I don't think any of us have that right, that luxury anymore, because for one thing, and I hate to be so crass and myopic, this is our country that this is happening in, and this is our children and now our grandchildren that are going to have to come out of this legal and moral morass that we have let ourselves into. So. I really want to say I think we have a huge fight ahead of us in terms of human rights. Thank you.